we all feel better.
If the dog, we all feel better.
In the dark.
And now our featured presentation. And hello, everybody. This is Thomas DJ.
And this is Derek Ferguson.
And welcome once again to Better in the Dark, your guide to science fiction, fantasy, and horror in the movies. And... Yes, straight out of Brooklyn. And today, we are going to be strapping on the web spinners, putting on the masks, and we're going to do a little bit of superheroing.
Okay.
This is going to be first in a number of episodes we're going to be doing, focusing on the Marvel comic movies, since we've got a couple coming out in 2007.
Call it Marvel at the Movies.
That is what we're planning on doing. Of course, the big one, the first one for this year is Spider-Man 3. So we'll be talking to this time about the Spider-Man franchise. We're going to go back, talk about some of the television shows, some of the cartoons, and look at the first two films to get you ready for seeing the film in the theaters, although probably considering this is going on a little late, you probably already saw it.
But it doesn't matter. You just will go watch it and then come back and listen to this and try to figure out how wrong we are or how right we were, at your discretion.
Spider-Man has been around, heck, for as long as I think we've been.
Spider-Man has been around since I was knee-high to a knee.
Mm-hmm.
Like most people, the first comic book I read probably was a Spider-Man. It was either that or Avengers.
In fact, and I'm willing to bet that you have the same experience, Derek, that Spider-Man was one of the two gateway drugs that introduced you to comics as a kid.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
That and, of course, the Batman TV show.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I have very vivid memories of running from school with my friend Fred to his house because he had a color television set in 1968.
Which was a big thing back then.
And watching the old Gantray Lawrence Spider-Man cartoon in 1960, which was on syndication and Channel 11, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Spider-Man, Spider-Man.
Perhaps the most famous theme song.
A Spider-Man. Next to the Batman. Well,
once
yeah.
again, gateway drug. For the way everybody rags on the Batman TV show and maybe rags on the 67 show now that we've had that abomination that was the 90s show. This was what got a lot of people interested in comics during the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. Everybody watched Batman. Everybody watched Spider-Man. And even people today, you walk up to them and start singing Spider-Man, Spider-Man. And I bet you 9 out of 10 people will be able to finish the rest of the song without missing a beat.
Well, let's talk a bit about the cartoon series, starting with the 67 cartoon, which was produced originally by Gantray Lawrence, who did all of the Marvel comic superhero cartoons at that time. You remember the Marvel superhero cartoons that came out roughly about a year earlier.
The Marvel superheroes have arrived. Yeah, the Mary Martin right. Marvel Society. Yeah, of course I remember that. But that was like very crude. Really wasn't even
animation.
Well,
the story goes that with those, Gantray Lawrence asked Stan Lee and John Romita Jr., who was the head of production at the time,
right.
to send them references. So they sent a whole crap load of comics, and the Gantray Lawrence people felt, oh, we're supposed to use these.
Yeah.
So they literally used those.
It was literal comic panels. I remember because right. I had some of the comic mm-hmm. books, and they just had cutouts of Thor and
right.
Hulk going at each other with the actual sound effects in there. It was a very weird way to do it. The character would be standing in a Kirby-esque
right.
kind of pose, and just the lips were moving. That was it. It was a weird cartoon. A lot of
it. We'll be getting to those when we get to one of the later episodes. Getting back to the Gantray Lawrence Spider-Man. This is only one season, after which place it gets taken over by Kranz Animation and Ralph Bakshi.
Right.
But there was a story that I've heard, and I really don't believe it's entirely true, but I want to throw it out there, that the first season of the Ralph Bakshi version was actually done first, but Bakshi made off with some money or something, and there's some sort of legal thing. So Gantry Lawrence basically stepped in it.
You could tell that somebody made off with the money because
oh.
they didn't have money to draw the webs on Spider-Man's
right.
costume, which is kind of stupid, except for the mask. The mask
right.
had webs.
The mask and the gloves.
And that was it.
The Gantry Lawrence episodes have a lot of charm to them. Some of them actually adapt stories directly from the
yeah.
comic. The Ralph Bakshi stories, which a lot of people like to say are the better.
Nah.
Oh, my. God, they're awful.
I'm not one of them, because in a lot of episodes, they had one horrendous episode where half of it was basically Spider-Man swinging.
I own the 67 series on DVD. So I was reviewing some of the episodes in preparation for this show. In each of the Bashi episodes, there's maybe about 5 to 7 minutes of actual story.
The
rest of it is all Gantry Lawrence stock footage. That's why I think Gantry Lawrence did come first.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the worst episodes, they took the same basic plot for 3 episodes and just redid them over and over and over again. Just changing the cosmetically, some of the character design.
They had one where Manhattan got lifted up into the
five
air.
Times.
Yeah.
5 times they used that story.
I swear, 20 minutes of the episode was Spider-Man swinging under the island of Manhattan.
Yeah. And they just changed the villain's design a bit. In one case, they gave him a fin on the top of his head.
Yeah.
And called him Dr. Atlantean.
Yeah. Even as a kid, I said, what the hell is this? You know, I could be watching something else. I don't have to watch
this. This is the one Spider-Man cartoon series that is available on DVD.
Really? That's the only one?
It's the only one.
Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends aren't
Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends has never been on DVD. The Spider-Man syndicated series, we'll get to in a few seconds, also never been on DVD.
Wow.
A couple of select episodes of...
See, I'd spring for Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. I would definitely...
I want to, though, briefly touch upon the one other live-action encounter Spider-Man had, which was in 1977. Universal signed a deal with Marvel to do TV movies based on 5 of their characters.
Nicholas Hammond played
Spider-Man. Okay. It was the only other TV movie besides The Hulk to actually make it to a television series. It was not very good, of course.
I think that only lasts maybe 2 seasons. Maybe 2?
It was a midsummer replacement for 2 years.
Because in the second season, he had the goofy belt.
Right.
And the web.
On the outside.
Now, the first season, he looked pretty good. The costume was decent for that time. But then the second season, like, all of a sudden he's wearing this goofy...
It was a weird sort of parallel universe Spider-Man. Nowhere near as weird as the Japanese.
I've
seen an episode of this. It is bizarre.
I've heard that thing is like nasty.
Unlike the Japanese series where you have Peter Parker is Japanese, and he has a dragster that he tools around in that turns into a giant mecha and fights giant monsters.
Okay.
This one is relatively true to the character, but there are a lot of changes to the background, so there's like no Aunt May in this one.
Right.
It was only lasted a very short time, and it was not particularly good.
I thought Nicholas Hammond was a good Peter Parker, though.
Mm-hmm.
I really did.
Well, overall, the Universal TV shows, with the exception maybe of the 2 Captain America movies, were very well cast in terms of the lead roles.
Yeah.
After this brief flirtation with live-action television...
Very brief.
Spider-Man came back in 1981. This was a rather strange thing in that they had 2 Spider-Man series going on simultaneously. There was a solo Spider-Man series, which went to syndication. And there was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, which is what everybody remembers. The one which teams Spider-Man up with Iceman and the original character Firestar.
Right.
Who may very well be the first example of a superhero created for television making its way into the mainstream Marvel Universe.
Right.
26 episodes was made for the syndicated show, which I've seen some episodes of.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same animation style as The Amazing Friends, same sort of approach. Over the course of 3 years, something like 24 episodes were made for Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. But so the one season that was 13 episodes, one season that was just 3 episodes, and it was a final season that I think it was like something like 8 episodes, for a grand total of 26.
Sounds to me like they just did it when they found a potload of money from somewhere and said, okay, well,
it's weird because there's so many different versions of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. It originally went out with Stan Lee introductions.
Right.
The syndicated versions remove certain key scenes, remove the Stan Lee intros, and the version that ran on UPN, back when UPN first started and they did their Sunday morning kids lineup.
Right.
They actually had repeats of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends on that lineup. And they altered it as well. They cut out the Stan Lee intros and they shortened it in like about 3 minutes.
More commercials.
Now, of course, the show that a lot of people consider to be the best Spider-Man cartoon series, but not me, and I don't think you. The Fox Television Amazing Spider-Man show started in 1990. There were 5 seasons, 65 episodes in all.
So it seems like it was longer.
Yeah, well, because the damn thing was so melodramatic in preparation for the show.
Like they ran it forever.
Because remember, after it was done on Fox,
it was like they refused to take this thing off the air. You know, they just kept it running and running and running. And maybe that's why it seems to me like it ran for like 10 years.
After they were done with it on Fox, they brought it over to ABC Family. That was
right.
on, and it was on that big block with Spider-Man Unlimited and X-Men and the Power Rangers.
Matter of fact, I still think it might be on. I meant to check before we did this show. The ABC Fox Family Channel. It's like they refused to take this thing off the air.
The show is noteworthy for a couple of reasons. It was the first time you had real celebrity voice talent.
Like John Vernon as
Doc Strange, which was actually...
Which was a damn good choice.
Now
somebody was thinking that.
Wallach playing Dr. Octopus.
Somebody was thinking. Somebody earned their paycheck that day.
Mark Hamill played the Hobgoblin. Most of the regular characters, though, with the exception of Ed Asner, who played J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah.
Who was probably the definitive J. Jonah Jameson until a certain J.K. Simmons came along. Most of the regular cast were standard voice talents. I think Neil Ross played Spider-Man in that show. It's very, very melodramatic. It's very over the top.
It's too frenetic. There's too much action. Considering the stuff that I write, people may be saying, Derrickson Ferguson complained about too much action. But yeah, there can be too much action when it's just like biff, bam, boom, pop, and you don't get a chance to catch your breath and say, okay, what is going on here? The other thing that I don't like about the show is that they seem determined to stick in as many Marvel superheroes as they could.
Well, because remember, you're talking about the 90s, where every cartoon had to sustain its own toy line.
Right.
Which is why the X-Men, which is also on Fox at the time, also had 15 billion characters every single season.
Every time you turn it around, I think they got it with the Black Panther, the Punisher, Daredevil, Iron Man. It seemed like everybody...
The thing that struck me that really I hated, after the first season, they decided that each season would be composed of an overreaching arc.
Right, okay.
That lasted 14 episodes, and it just made my head hurt. It was so involved, and everything was so pitched at 11.
Yeah.
Even quiet scenes between Peter and Mary Jane were very, very over-the-top playing to the rafters.
I mean, it made soap operas look like Shakespeare.
And the other important thing about this show was that it was a early example of the attempt to integrate CGI with standard animation.
Right.
And boy, did it look bad.
Especially since, like you said, it was an early effort, and they hadn't got the CGI technique down yet. It was just too jarring. It took you out of being absorbed into the story. First of all, to have a season-long story arc for an animated series, 30 minutes, that's a little bit ambitious, I think. I think if they had just had shorter story arcs of 3 or 4 episodes, it would have worked much better.
Well, they ended up doing that with the last season, where they cut it down into 3 shorter arcs.
Right.
And it worked a bit better. Although there was still carryover from the various arcs into each other.
Right.
It was just, I think, too loud and...
It was too loud, too much, just too everything.
Like I said, a lot of people love this show.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons they love it is because so many of the Spider-Man characters are depicted in it.
Well, just about everybody who was important to Spider-Man,
The Spot showed up.
The Spot, yeah.
The Rocket Racer showed up.
They put in everybody. So if you're a Spider-Man fan, you can't complain about it.
There's also one other significant thing about this show, but we'll get to that when we get to the Blade episode in the Marvel at the Movies.
Okay.
Yes, a little teaser. There's one more TV show before we get to the movies, which is, of course, what everybody wants to hear about. In 2003, after the release of the first film, they made a big deal about this. If you remember in the news, they signed Brian Michael Bendis, who at the time was writing Ultimate Spider-Man, to be the story editor for a new Spider-Man series that was going to be on MTV. This was the one that they, what they called the 3D look animation.
Yeah.
You've seen this series. I haven't.
I've seen it. You know why? Because they put it on, I think, 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. And,
some weird voice talents, too, on this one.
Yeah.
Neil Patrick Harris as Peter Parker. Lisa Loeb. If everybody remembers Lisa Loeb, she was the girl that sang Day. My favorite weird voice casting was Rob Zombie as the Lizard.
Again, somebody earned their paycheck.
Yeah.
And what I thought was really interesting was that they did the movie version of the Kingpin in this one from Daredevil.
Right, because they had...
Because they even got
Michael
Clark Duncan doing the voice, and it was a black Kingpin, which I thought was really interesting.
It only lasted one season.
So. Well, you know what? Because the stories were very simplistic. Usually it was just Peter Parker, Mary Jane, and Harry Osborn.
Right.
And that was it. There wasn't no Aunt May. There wasn't any of the other supporting characters. They kept it to the bare minimum.
They tried to introduce a lot of original characters, from what I understand.
Yeah, they did. Well, there's Brian Michael Bendis, who everybody worships at his altar, but not me, because it seems to me like he says, I'm going to do my Spider-Man, and that's it. I'm not concerned with the traditional version of Spider-Man. But you forgot one Spider-Man series.
Which one?
Which I'm really surprised at you about. Spider-Man Unlimited.
Oh, gosh. I'm just trying to forget it. That's why.
Oh, okay.
One season. They used the same voice talents.
That was the crazy. You know what I think it is?
That one was 1999. They used the same voice talents that they used for the Fox Spider-Man series.
Right.
Neil Ross was still Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. It was an entirely different animation style. And the idea was Spider-Man gets trapped on a rocket ship piloted by John Jameson.
Yeah.
And Venom and Carnage are on that same rocket ship, and they go to
Counter-Earth.
And there's another Green Goblin, and there's a Vulture character.
But this Counter-Earth is futuristic. It's 200 years in the future, and Peter Parker gets a new spider suit that's made.
Which is based on the old Spider-Man 2099 suit.
In 30 seconds, he gets to Counter-Earth, and he becomes acclimated to everything that's going on. And I think that, if you remember, Batman Beyond was very hot. So
very bizarre.
I think somebody said, let's do a version of that. You looked at it, you said, my God. Who thought of this?
Very strange, strange show that only... In fact, it didn't even last a season. The final two episodes ended up being aired on ABC Family because Fox took it off.
With good reason. They should have never put it on.
Now we're done with television.
Okay.
We know what you're here for. The movies.
Da, 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 da.
There was a long, long, long and torturous road that Spider-Man took to the movies. Back in the 80s, the Canon Film Group signed a deal with Marvel to bring Spider-Man to the screen, which we're all kind of grateful for because we all remember the Captain America movie that came out from that same deal. And that's something I guess we'll talk about in a later episode.
Yeah, after we've had a couple of drinks.
For a while, it looked like James Cameron was going to be Spider-Man director. And in fact, he wrote a script that featured two villains, one of which was vaguely based on the character of Electro, and one of which was vaguely based on the character of the Sandman. Which
Supposedly, this famous scriptment was so brilliant that everybody who read it immediately turned to gold.
Right.
You know, supposedly that's how good it was.
For a while, David Fincher was going to direct the... But he ended up not doing it because he did not want to do the origin story. And Sony insisted that there would be an origin story.
Mm-hmm.
So they ended up going to independent filmmaker Mr. Sam Raimi, best known for the Evil Dead films.
Right.
Dark Man. A Simple Plan, The Gift. He had slowly been getting that sort of reputation as kind of like an art house director.
Right.
With these smaller films like Simple Plan, The Gift. He was a lifelong comic book fan, and you only had to see the Evil Dead films and Dark Man.
And Dark Man, of course, yeah.
To know this. First thing that happened, remember the big controversy when he started casting and Tobey Maguire was cast?
It was the same thing as when Michael Keaton was cast as Batman, mm-hmm. and comic book fans lost their mind. They said, why'd you get Arnold Schwarzenegger doing it?
Well, people forget that Spider-Man, particularly in the Steve Ditko era, which is what Sam Raimi was taking his cues from,
right,
was a scrawny, spindly, insect-like creature.
He's as thin as a broom handle. Spider-Man is not a muscular guy. I looked at Tobey Maguire, and I said, I can see it.
I was less interested, and I still am to this day, you know what's coming up.
And they're going to hate you for this, Tom.
By Kristen Dunst has Mary Jane Watson. First off, woman has a snaggletooth. Woman's supposed to be a supermodel, and she's got a snaggletooth. Mary Jane is a character, even in the comics.
She's not your idea of what Mary Jane should look like.
She's not anybody's idea of what Mary Jane looks like. Mary Jane
she's been in three movies now, so somebody obviously...
Okay, well, I'm just saying. Mary Jane has always been portrayed as being a real va-va-va-voom girl. And Kirsten Dunst, don't get me wrong, is attractive enough, but she's not a va-va-va-voom girl.
Well, who would you got?
Nikki Koch, who now is a little bit long in the tooth, but back when these films were first being made, she was just coming off of Unhappily Ever After.
Right.
I think she could have done it.
You listen, I understand what you're saying. I'm just saying that I think you're a little bit hard on the girl. She's not your idea of Mary Jane, okay? I understand that. I sympathize. But know something? At this point, it hardly matters because she is Mary
That's
Jane.
That's right. Other casting decisions I loved, you and I made a reference to this earlier, J.K. Simmons, who is J. Jonah Jameson. Yeah,
this is one of them examples like Christopher Reeve,
right,
where you look at him and he looks so much like the character. It's scary because just people in real life aren't supposed to look like people in comic books. I saw this guy. I said, oh my God. It was worth paying the money just to see J. Jonah Jameson come to life.
That one scene in the first film where he's sitting there talking with Peter Parker, and he's saying, I'm going to put the headline, Spider-Man, Menace to Society. And Peter goes, wait a minute, no, that's libel. He goes, no, no, that's not libel. Libel is spoken. Written is slander.
Spider-Man wasn't attacking the city. He was trying to save it. That's slander.
It is not. I resent that. Slander is spoken. In print, it's libel.
And yet the thing I love about the character is that when he's surrounded by the Green Goblin, that first one, what does he do? He protects Peter to the end. This is one of the things that...
You can see that he's a human being. See, people got the mistaken notion that J. Jonah Jameson is this one-note character that hates Spider-Man. But he doesn't like Spider-Man for... He doesn't like superheroes for a reason, because J. Jonah Jameson is a guy that came up the hard way. He worked for what he got. And to him, he sees these superheroes getting all this glory and attention, things they really haven't deserved, when it should be the common man that should be exalted. So that's where he's coming from. That's the humanity of the
character. Other great casting came, of course, even though the costume sucked ass, in the choice of Mr. Willem Dafoe. Has Norman Osborn. And what was really uncanny is they got James Franco, who really looks like he could be Willem Dafoe's son.
And that's one of my pet peeves in movies, is that they get people to play father and son or mother and daughter that look absolutely nothing like each other. For once, they got two actors that look like they could actually be father and son. It's little touches like that that made the first movie so memorable, because they were paying attention to these details.
Also, a great Aunt May, Uncle Ben combination. Rosemary Harris and Cliff Robertson.
Cliff Robertson.
You want to hear something that I just learned that I thought was really bizarre? Even though Cliff Robertson is older than Uncle Ben is supposed to be in the comics,
They
had to put old age makeup on him because he looks too good for his age.
I believe it. I really seen pictures of Cliff Robbins, and I can't believe he's been around forever.
Ever, yeah.
Like the 50s, I think, that he started his career.
Of course, Bruce Campbell shows up. In fact, I can't wait for the third film, because supposedly Bruce Campbell is playing Quentin Beck.
If
you're a Spider-Man fan, you know who Quentin Beck is.
Really? Now this is going to be fun to watch. But he's been in every movie.
Yes, he has been.
But he's like Sam Raimi's good luck charm. Mm-hmm. I heard that he always finds a spot for him.
The thing that I liked about the first film, I do not like it as much as you do. I like the second one better than the first one.
Well, see, now we flip-flop, because I didn't like the second as much as you did, so.
The thing I like, though, about the first one, way over the second one, is there's a real incredible sense of New York.
In the
comics, New York is as much a character as Spider-Man
absolutely.
As somebody who's lived in New York all my life, I saw very specific locations that I knew from being a New York. I could tell you exactly where Peter's high school is.
Right.
I could tell you the exact location of his street.
It was a tremendous sense of reality. To me, Spider-Man is a quintessential New York hero.
Right.
I like the fact that he's totally covered up so that nobody knows who he is.
Right.
He could be black, he could be white, he could be Asian, he could be Hispanic. So that's why I think people like him so much, because he could be anybody.
Which is why you get these scenes in each of these films where the people of New York sort of come to his defense.
Exactly. Because he could be anybody. It's a really...
There's only one moment in the film that rings false as being New York, and that's that stupid World Unity Festival.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's supposed to be in Times Square.
Yeah, it's supposed to be in Times Square.
Yeah, but you know it's not Times Square.
It's in Neuronto, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And it's obvious that they've CGI'd all of these huge monolithic buildings and stuff like that. That is not on Times Square at all.
Speaking of the CGI, there are a lot of technical problems with the first film. A lot of continuity errors. There's one scene, in fact, it's a lovely scene, with Peter and Mary Jane in their respective backyards, and they're talking about their futures.
Right.
And there is a necklace that appears and disappears on Mary Jane's neck about 3 times during the course of that scene.
What are you doing looking at her neck?
Well, it makes me avoid looking at her hairline, which also changes.
Oh, man.
She has the worst freaking dye job. Almost as bad as the Halle Berry Storm. Her dye job in that first film is awful.
You were supposed to be paying attention to the dialogue.
Well, it's great dialogue, I'll admit. That's a wonderful scene. It's a lot of technical flaws.
A necklace missing that.
The Green Goblin gets a serious redesign in the film. A lot of people refer to him as looking like a Power Ranger.
Well, listen, again, here we go into this thing, which you know I always get on, is that it doesn't freak me out when they change things as much. Like the organic web shooters. Remember that?
I don't, gosh, it was like they were ready to string Sam Raimi up for
that. But to me, the organic web shooters make more sense because out of everything that's in the Spider-Man mythos, the one thing that doesn't make any sense is Peter Parker needs money. If he's smart enough to create these webs that can tie up somebody, you're telling me any police department in the world wouldn't pay a fortune?
Right. Or 3M. That would have solved the whole problem. Hi, 3M. Look, I've created a universal adhesive.
That'll bond to anything, and it'll dissolve in an hour.
Right.
The
medical application of something like that
alone would have made Peter Parker a billionaire overnight. So when he changed it to being something organic, I say, you know something? That's a perfect example of how he improved on the original.
Right. Also created a nice power discovery scene. Starting in the cafeteria and leading out to, of course, that wonderful point where he's standing on the rooftop trying to figure out how to get the web. Go web, Shazam!
Yeah, Shazam and all that stuff. But yeah, they were going to string up the guy, for it. It was a definite improvement over the web shooting, and it explained why Peter Parker, even though he's supposed to be this science wizard, you have a high school student that can create something like that. I mean, to me, that's always been a bit much. I'm sorry.
I also like the fact that unlike, let's say, something like Daredevil, which seems to take place in the course of 3 days. This film, it's obvious that a lot of time passes from the first frame to the last. So it's much easier to take the developments.
It takes its time to tell the story.
Right.
It doesn't try to crowd it, like you said, with Daredevil. It takes its time and explores the characters, the situations, and allows us to get to know Peter Parker, which is the main thing that you want to do, because it's the guy in the suit that we want to know about.
Right, and I think Tobey Maguire does a really great job of creating this kind of tortured loner type.
Right.
He perpetually put upon, and part of the reason he's not going around bopping everybody in the face after he gets these powers is because he's probably been put upon so much.
Oh, yeah.
That it's reflex behavior.
Somebody says something out of the way, he automatically draws back into his shell.
And it kind of becomes even more of a deal in the second film. Because you have him getting a lot of abuse from a lot of people.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, see, you liked the second movie a lot more than I did. I didn't like it. For the first hour, we were relentlessly beat over the head with how much Peter Parker's life sucks. Okay, I got it. The guy's life is bad. Can we move on already and get on with the rest of the story? What, he's working the pizza job?
Yeah. By the way, another little weird bit of trivia, the guy who's the owner of the pizza place in that first sequence is now one of the correspondents on The Daily Show. I was sitting there going like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, the guy from Spider-Man 2.
I don't want to give the impression that I hated the first film in any way, because I loved this movie when I first saw it with a bunch of my friends, Steve Roman, who you've met, I think.
Yeah, Steve. We went to see Identity.
We saw it with a bunch of people, and it was...
Which is the best way to see Spider-Man, frankly. Round up a bunch of your friends who are also comic book fans.
Right.
And you guys all go and have a good time.
I mean, some of the CGI is really, really hokey in here. But you don't notice it on the big screen when you're surrounded by a bunch of people getting all...
Of course not. You notice it now because it's been, what, like six, seven years since we had that, and the CGI effects have gotten more sophisticated. So now you look at
Although there's some really bad CGI in too.
Oh, yeah.
Really bad.
There's some bad, which we'll get to that when we
we're going to get to that in a few minutes. There's a lot of strong performances overall. I just felt it was kind of a little on the lacking side.
I think it ranks right up there. Well, of course, it doesn't surpass Superman, which to me is, everybody knows who know me knows, I consider that the Gone with the Wind of superhero movies. But it's on that same level as an origin story. I mean, it's got everything in there that we want to see in a Spider-Man movie. So it's right up there with Superman.
Well, there's a definite character arc in that first film. Because remember, there's that whole scene where he basically tells Ben, you're not my father. Stop trying to be my father.
I don't mean to lecture and I don't mean to preach. And I know I'm not your father.
Then stop pretending to be.
Right.
But he learns to accept the fact that this man shaped who he is.
Exactly.
In the tail end, when you have that, you have the scene with him and Willem Dafoe, and he's going, I'm like a father to you. It's like, no, I have a father.
I have a father, yeah.
His name is Ben Parker.
That's a wonderful scene. What did you think of the whole relationship between Willem Dafoe and Peter Parker?
It's one of those things that has become now part of the mythos in the comic. I don't know how I felt. Obviously, Willem Dafoe is a great actor. He gave a great performance. You know, one of my favorite scenes is him having the conversation with himself in the mirror.
In the mirror.
I don't understand.
Did you think it was coincidence?
So many good things all happening for you. All for you, Norman.
Where you could see that he's developed different body languages.
Yeah.
For Norman and for the Goblin.
It's really a remarkable piece of acting, just that one scene that you say. I love Willem Dafoe. I'll watch him in anything anyway.
Well, one of the strengths of the Spider-Man franchise so far is that instead of going for big-name stars, Sam Raimi have cast people who are great actors who can grow into the part.
Which I think is the secret to any superhero movie, period. Don't always go for the big name. Get, like you said, solid actors that will commit themselves to doing the work of making it believable.
I don't know how I feel about the whole idea of Norman trying to be a father figure for Peter. Partially because he had enough problems with Harry as it is. He's a terrible father to Harry. Even in the comics, he was a terrible father to Harry. And it just seemed weird that he wants this other son.
But he's a scientist and Peter's a scientist, so naturally that's the thing.
But you know what? You look at it in the context of the arc of these three films, and it gives a much more resonance to Harry's story. Because Harry is the spurned son. He's the black sheep.
He's
almost
the black sheep. Of
the first one is really good, and I have it on DVD. I recommend people seek it out.
Oh yeah, by all means.
But then a couple of years later, we get Spider-Man 2.
Why? Because the first one made a whole lot of money.
The first one is number 11 on the all-time greatest grossing film.
Right.
They decided to go with Dr. Octopus, who apparently was Sam Raimi's choice for the first film.
For the first one, actually.
And the decision was that the technology wasn't there yet to do Dr. Octopus well. But then Raimi hired a group of puppeteers who showed that it was possible to do Dr. Octopus, do the whole arms. It was like a special rig that was green screens that Albert Molina wore that he was able to manipulate.
Oh, really? Okay.
That was then replaced using CGI. With
I wonder
the,
how they... to give him something to act with.
Exactly.
So that, he didn't have
to just...
In fact,
he had Larry, Barry, Flo, and Mo.
Okay.
Were the name of the four... Supposedly, each one of the four tentacles had its own personality. Once again, Sam Raimi doesn't go for a big name. Goes for Albert Molina.
Which is probably the best thing about the whole movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, without a doubt.
He was Dr. Octopus.
He was perhaps best known in the circles of science fiction, fantasy, and horror for being the guy that betrays Indy in that first sequence in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Although, of the Lost Ark.
He also had a fairly large role in the first Species film.
I didn't like it.
Okay.
I didn't like the Species. The only thing I liked about it had Michael Madsen and Mark Helgeberger. Right. That was it.
And Forrest Whitaker as the psychic.
Right, Forrest Whitaker. That was it. That's the only thing I liked about the movie.
Well, are you ready for Species 4, which is coming out?
Well, haven't they turned that into softcore porn?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Like, the first one wasn't softcore porn. It was, hey, look at Natasha Henstridge naked. That's basically all it was.
That's why I didn't like it. And I know now guys are saying, what, he doesn't want to see her naked? It's not that, just that it was a half-baked alien ripoff.
One of the things I liked about the character of Dr. Octopus in the film is that, unlike in the comics where he's always been like this weird guy.
Yeah.
He always was a little squirrely.
He always was half-baked.
Sam Raimi takes a page from the Batman franchise and shows us what Otto Octavius was like. And we realize he's a really together guy.
He was really got a lovely wife, nice home, wonderful career.
And even though he at first is like, oh, I have no time for you. Once he realizes how much Peter loves knowledge, he becomes, more so, I think, than Norman Osborn ever was in the first film.
Right.
He becomes a father figure.
Like a father. Yeah, because Peter looks at him and he says, wow, this is the type of
he
life
he has it all. What we start with in the second film, first off, there's that wonderful credit sequence. One of the few times I've liked Alex Ross's artwork, where you have the recap of the first film.
Which was a brilliant way to bring you up to date for people who hadn't seen the first one. It told you everything that you needed to know. I think, is there hardly a person who doesn't know how Spider-Man got a superpower?
I think Spider-Man is one of the only Marvel characters that is so iconic like Superman and Batman.
Yeah,
if you came up to them and asked a total stranger, they'd be able to tell you chapter and verse.
Uh-huh. But still, if you got to look at credit, the worst thing to do to look at Alex Ross's artwork.
Oh, of course. I've always found Alex Ross's artwork to be too mannered and painterly. I think here it worked because it's not really a comic book. Because it's a movie, it worked more for me.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of new additions to the cast. After being referenced in the first film, Dr. Curtis Connors shows up.
Yeah.
played by Dylan Baker, and he's in the third one. Okay. And there is some even money on the fact maybe Lizard out in the fourth one.
No foreshadowing?
Well, that's the cool thing, is that they've been foreshadowing. Heck, they've been foreshadowing Venom since the first film, because there is a definite, very strong reference to Eddie Brock at some point.
Right, he's mentioned a couple of times in the first and the second movie.
That's one of the things I do like, is that there's this definite sense of a continuity, so it's not like in the Batman films. Okay, here's a new set of bad guys that we've got to set up.
They virtually exist in like own universe.
Yeah.
You don't get a feeling one of them really follows after the other.
And there's another potential bad guy introduced in the second one in the form of John Jameson, the Man-Wolf.
The guy that steals Mary Jane.
One of the big problems I have with the second film is that the Mary Jane relationship is really annoying.
Now that I gotta give it to you. Everything about this movie to me, with the exception of Alfred Molina, is annoying. One minute you're so in love with this guy that you're ready to die for him, and now you're gonna go
marry
him.
Although they make it very clear with that whole scene where they're in the apartment when she's making John kiss her upside down.
Yeah, and all this.
And you know that she's kind of suspecting almost from that last moment in the first film that Peter and Spider-Man are the same person. Also, another problem I had with the second film is that sense of New Yorkness is gone.
Yeah.
Part of it is because so much of it was not filmed in New York. Portions of it were filmed in Chicago and in the back lot. Obviously, there are scenes in the first film that are in the back lot, particularly the confrontation with the muggers in the rain. It's all Sony back lot.
Yeah.
It's not as obvious as in this one, where there's a lot of back lot work. As exciting and as great as the subway fight scene is in this film, there's no place like it.
There's
in
no place like that in
New York.
A train track that goes to the end, and it's an elevated train track, and it just stops.
I mean, I thought for a while that what they were going for was the Metro North line going out of Manhattan,
because
that does become an elevated line.
Yeah, yes, it does.
But it doesn't stop at the East River. Does.
And I'm sorry, that fight scene on it bored the hell out of me. The CGI guys
at some points is really bad.
That
one and the clock tower fight, the CGI is really showing.
Yeah. Although the clock tower fight was marginally better than everybody makes a big deal about the train.
You know what I think the thing is? Is that in the first film, most of the action sequences happen at night. So it's easier to disguise CGI, particularly because you're dealing with fight scenes where you're switching from human to CGI several times during the source of the fight.
Well, that's why I think, to digress for a minute, everybody says, well, why in the hell did they have that fight scene at night when he fights
the
gamma dogs? Well, they had it at night because it's easier to hide the CGI mistakes if you have scenes at night. If you recall, there's only one daytime scene with the Hulk where he fights the army.
And I think that the fact is that most of the fight scenes in the second film happen during the day. The bank robbery.
Yeah, the bank robbery.
The clock tower.
Clock tower.
I mean, there's one big, big hole in that story in the scene leading up to the clock tower.
And I didn't like the thing with Aunt May, and she's being flung around like a rat. We're talking about a frail old woman.
Although, you know what? I liked the handling of Aunt May better in this film. Mm-hmm. Even though, she's being flung around and all that.
Yeah,
it was more in keeping with, and it's one of the few things I like about the J. Michael Straczynski run of Spider-Man, was that he made Aunt May into a strong person.
Right.
Because you're sitting there, you're going, here's a woman who basically has raised a son into adulthood for a large portion of his teenage years by herself at an advanced age. He has to have a will of iron.
Oh, backbone.
And I think they really showed that in the second film. They really did allow Rosemary Harris to show that backbone.
And maybe it's just me, but it seems to me like from her dialogue, and I don't know if this is her spin she's putting on it, that I think that she knows that Peter is a...
Oh, yeah. Spider-Man. Oh, no, I think it's definite.
But she's not letting on for whatever reason.
Well, she probably figures Peter has his own reasons.
Yeah, he's got his own life.
I think that speech, when she's packing up to go to the apartment.
Yeah.
The speech with the little kid, and he's saying, oh, Henry's hero is Spider-Man, and we all need heroes.
Mm-hmm.
That whole speech is her basically saying, I know who you are, you need to go out and do that again.
Yeah, do it again.
Without out and out saying it.
Yeah, it's a very, very...
Well, Rosemary Harris is a great actress.
She's phenomenal. I love her. Again, perfect casting.
James Franco, who plays Harry Osborn, and is very good in the first film, goes a little in the melodrama area in this one.
Wait, it's not easy being the second banana, which is basically what he's doing. He's good second
banana. Well, keep in mind also, we're dealing with, Harry Osborn in the comics was a little squirrely.
That's true, too.
So it's not surprising. Like, I think there are certain areas where he goes so over the top, it jars. And I think the biggest thing is that the whole sense of New York is gone. There are at least five different sequences that use the same park, the park outside City Hall. They use that same park area, like, about five times in five different portions in the movie. I think that there's a stronger villain.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah,
In the second one.
Yeah, Alfred Molina. For me, if I watch the movie right now, I watch it mainly because his performance.
I think the plot is a lot more credible in this one.
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite sure what the hell Green Goblin is doing hanging around after he kills all the shareholders and allows Norman to keep his company. After that's done at the World Unity Festival, his goals have been accomplished.
Yeah.
Why is he still hanging around in the goofy outfit?
Because we got about 45 minutes left to go in the movie. That's why.
Yeah, whereas there's a very credible reason why Dr. Octopus is doing everything he's doing.
He's got a plan, and we understand why he's doing what he's doing every
time. I mean, I think the one weakness in the ongoing storyline, in the ongoing arc, is Mary Jane. Mary Jane has a couple of good points, but she keeps coming back.
You just will not give the girl a break.
I'm sorry! And the thing is, okay, in the comics, it made sense because we had that revelation that Mary Jane always knew that Peter was Spider-Man. And that makes all that squirrely behavior that happened in the years before make sense.
Why was she acting like such an empty bubblehead?
Whereas in the movie continuity, she doesn't learn she's Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that kind of sort of bothered me about the second film. Tobey Maguire taking his frickin' mask off every 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Again, yeah.
Secret
Identity.
As nice as that scene was on the train car, where they're all looking at him and going, oh my God, he's barely a kid.
He's just a kid.
He could be my son's age.
Yeah, I like
it. It could still be done with the mask on.
Yeah. Every 5 minutes he said, well, then no.
I love, though, how he played off the expectations from when we saw in the first film, where Robert Molina shows up, Vince Pastore looking guy goes, you're going to have to go through me. And me. Okay.
But didn't they take that from an actual scene in a comic book?
I'm not sure.
It seems to me that was done in a 60s
Spider-Man. I took it as being a gag on that first film with the guys throwing the stuff off the bridge. I don't recall any specific comic book scene it was referencing. Oh, there are a lot of comic book references in the film. The Spider-Man No More.
You're right. Exactly. Yeah. They did it exactly just like the cover.
Right.
Just like the cover.
Yeah. And of course, the whole sequence where Spider-Man gets his costume back is all from issue number 51.
Right. Yeah.
It ends in a positive note. But Mary Jane.
It doesn't just so much end; it just runs out of energy.
But she just basically says, "Yo, here, I've been doing this all my life. Come on, let me in." Finally,
it just runs out of energy. Well, we've had the fight; the villain is defeated. Okay. It's just such a by the numbers.
Right. Speaking about by the numbers, another thing that kind of sort of bugged me was how it almost followed the formula of the first one too closely. At the exact same point in both films, there's a big fire.
Yeah, you could tell. Okay, this is going to be the first fight.
Right.
Now, seeing with Aunt May. See, you can look at your watch and tell what's going to happen when in the second one.
I guess I just think that this one worked better because I thought there was more of a...
You just sat here and named 12 things that you didn't like. And you said
but
that
you know
it
what?
Works better.
I think it still works better than the first one.
Listen, if it worked for you, that's the main thing. Me,
yeah.
I'll watch it. But see, I won't sit there and just watch it straight through like I'll watch the first one. The first one, I won't get up. Second one, I'll pause it, go get me something to eat. Or I'll even let it run because
okay,
I know...
Okay, let me tell you about this one massive plot hole. Okay, if you recall, at some point during the film, Harry Osborn tells Dr. Octopus, I'll get you what you need if you get me Spider-Man.
Okay.
So how does he do this? He tracks down Peter Parker. Because I think actually Harry tells him, find Peter Parker, you'll find Spider-Man.
Well, of course, which everybody
does. So Dr. Octopus finds Peter Parker, and Peter Parker is having a heart-to-heart with Mary Jane. He knows that the only way to get to Spider-Man is to get a hold of Peter Parker. Oh. So why in frickin' hell does he throw a big old car at them? Remember, he doesn't know that he's Spider-Man at this point.
Right.
That is the one big plot hole that I think really screws
them. Oh, yeah, because he could have killed him.
Then you're kind of crap
and
out of luck.
And he's supposed to be bringing Spider-Man to the guy so that he can get the money. So,
get the tritium.
He throws it through there because the CGI guys...
Thought it would be cool.
You're paying these CGI guys a lot of money.
The cool spot happens after the car gets thrown. Where they're looking at the coffee cups and they're hearing the vibrations.
Oh, the Jurassic Park thing.
They could have done it without the car through the
window. But you know what I think it is? Happens also in a lot of these movies. Not just, you know, the superhero movies, but all movies with special effects. Did you get these CGI guys, they get so carried away and they say, well, listen, we can do this. We can do that. Right. We can do that. Let us do this. Let us do that. And the director feels under such pressure because, after all, he's got to deliver a movie that's going to make $50-60 million the first weekend, that he says, okay, go ahead and put it in there. Regardless of whether it makes sense or not, I'm looking at Van Helsing here, which they didn't even need a director for that.
Oh, movie. I think we're getting to that in the Movies That Suck So Bad episode.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy. That's where we are at this point. We are now at the third film, which is going to be released, as of this recording, tomorrow. I got a couple of reservations about this one.
And they are... Too many villains.
Okay, I was about to say, remember in the Batman movies?
Too many villains. Like, we've got what? Sandman. We've got Venom.
Apparently, Sam Raimi only wanted to use Sandman and this new Goblin. Which, they're not even sure what they're calling this guy yet. They're not releasing if Harry's going to be the Hobgoblin or the new Green Goblin.
Well, I've seen...
For a while, he was being called the Night Flyer.
In the trailers and stuff like that, he doesn't even wear a mask. He's flying around.
But looks like a skateboard. Looks like the Rocket Racer.
It looks like the hoverboard from Back to the Future, actually. He's not even wearing a mask. But he's going to be one of the villains, apparently.
And, like I said... Bruce Campbell is listed in the credits as Quentin Beck. For those of you who are not familiar with the comic book mythos, Quentin Beck is my favorite Spider-Man villain of all time.
Oh, my God.
Mysterio.
Jokes. Who doesn't love a guy with eyeballs on his head and a big fishbowl for a head?
I think that they're biting him up. Plus, on top of that, in addition to having to introduce two new villains, which, by the way, don't get me wrong, expertly casted. When they said Thomas Hayden Church was being the Sandman,
I
was like, that is the scariestly perfect casting.
Again, somebody earned their paycheck that day. But when I saw how many villains that they have, didn't they learn anything from Batman?
Because and on top of that, they're introducing Gwen Stacy. And could somebody please explain to me why they hired the blonde to play the redhead and the redhead to play the blonde?
Because it's Hollywood, my friend.
M. Night Shyamalan recommended Bryce Dallas Howard to Sam Raimi.
Oh, wow.
He's playing Gwen Stacy, who in the comics was Peter's second, because we forgot about Betty Brand.
She's coming in.
Captain Stacy, her father, who's the first person probably to figure out who Spider-Man was.
Well, the guy was a police detective.
Yeah.
Again, that's a lot of characters to introduce.
You've got to explain
their stories and their relation. And then, if he's got all these villains in there, he's got to have a fight scene with each and every one of them. So I'm saying, what is this?
Plus, they're going to have to go through the whole symbiote story first off before getting to that.
Yeah. I mean, what is this?
I'm willing to bet that they're going to...
Is this like a four-hour movie?
2 hours and 18 minutes.
Get out of here.
I'm willing to bet that they're going to be going the 90s cartoon series route with the symbiote and basically have John Jameson bring it down from...
Right.
And once again, Dylan Baker's going to be in this. I'm assuming John Jameson's going to be in this. The problem with every time you introduce new characters, you have to bring up that character's backstory. You have to give some sort of backstory
to it. This is what I'm saying. It's a lot of characters.
Now, in the case of somebody like Eddie Brock, we're prepared for that because we've already got some things established about him.
We know he's a rival photographer. We know he works on the Bugle. So we know something about the character.
And there's also the weird implication that they've been making in the trailers that William Baker / Flint Marko, aka the Sandman, is responsible for Uncle Ben's death.
That turns me off right then and there. Why do you have to drag that into there? Because that's another element that you're dragging into that eats up screen time. But I guess they figured that they needed to have some kind of emotional shorthand for reason why Spider-Man is in conflict with him.
Another strange and bizarre thing about this one is that there's so much going on, and you have the Gwen Stacy story. Mm-hmm. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the comics, Gwen Stacy was killed by the Green Goblin on... Depending upon which day of the week it was either the Brooklyn Bridge or the George Washington Bridge.
Definitely the
Queensborough Bridge. And the thing is, they've done that set piece already in... the first film. They did it in the first movie. On the Queensborough Bridge. So the question is, what are they going to do? Because there's talk that Kirsten Dunst is not going to go on. Sony has said, we're doing six of these things.
You know how much money they're making from these? They're going to keep the cash cow going.
It would not surprise me if Kirsten Dunst is getting kind of tired. I can imagine Tobey Maguire having nightmares about being 40 years old and playing a 22-year-old.
But you know he's also got back injuries.
Yeah, exactly.
From doing the role.
Which is why we almost had Jake Gyllenhaal in Spider-Man 2.
Spider-Man 2.
So I can understand introducing Gwen Stacy just in case Kristen Dunst decides enough is
enough. Yeah, exactly.
You already have established.
You've got another love interest.
Although this does smack of Lana Lang showing up in Superman 3.
But again, what else are you going to do? If you're going to keep the franchise going, you got to introduce new characters.
Right.
So Kristen Dunst, who I believe all of them were only contracted
for three
movies.
Yeah. So right now, the party line is that Kristen Dunst would definitely come back if Sam Raimi comes back for 4. Quite frankly, if he wants to take some time off, more power to him. I mean, granted, this is a man who once said, I'm happy being Spider-Man's bitch for the rest of my life.
And the paycheck isn't bad either. And I know that a lot of comic book fans don't like to hear this, and I'm sorry, but we all live in the real world. They like to think that these people do these movies because they love the comics and love the characters.
Oh, just listen to Comic Geek speak and hear Peter Rios go on about, get in the damn costume every couple of years and get me my movie. That's not how it works in the real world.
No, they do these movies because they pay a lot of money, and they can live off of that money.
Right.
Pay their bills, put a roof
and
over their
head. Sam Raimi has so much else
and
he wants
to do. Right, and go off and do other projects.
Because Sam Raimi just bought the rights to the Street and Smith pulp characters. He wants to do the Shadow. He wants to do Doc Savage.
I want to see him do Doc Savage.
You know, I want to see him do the Avenger.
Go do Doc Savage. Okay, somebody else can do Spider-Man.
Somebody made a suggestion on the Hollywood Saloon, which we've mentioned a couple of times in the past. www.hollywoodsaloon.com. Highly recommended podcast.
Giving them a free play?
Because they're really good and I get information from them sometimes. Came up with the idea of contacting James Cameron in his little house below the sea and see if he wants to take over for an issue or two.
I like that. Didn't he go crazy about it?
He's become obsessed with ocean life now.
Yeah, and he actually bought something underwater.
Hey, he could have Hydra Man as the villain for all we care. Although, the logic would be, I would think for 4, since we've seen Dylan Baker for 2 episodes, let's see the Lizard. Once again, we have the actor in place. He's a good enough actor.
We've already seen him.
And in 2, you see, once again, the continuity problems. There are a couple of shots where you realize that dude has a second arm.
Yeah, well, I thought that they would probably CG that out, much like they did in Forrest Gump, what they did for
Gary Sinise's legs.
Yeah. To the point that a lot of people actually thought that he had his legs cut off.
What do you think? Is 3 going to start a downward spiral, or is it going to stay consistent with the quality?
No. 3 is going
to... Well, 3 is going to make money.
Exactly.
Because fanboys have been screaming.
It hardly matters what I think, or what you think, or what anybody thinks. There's a lot of them, matter of fact, have already got their tickets.
Right. And the thing is, a lot of the fanboys have been screaming for Venom since day one,
right.
The first time this has been announced. They've wanted Venom, and apparently Sam Raimi did not want to do any of the modern-day villains, and it was Avi Arad who said to him, you got to sometimes do something for them, not just for you.
Exactly. So this one...
And it's Topher Grace. Topher Grace, he's not a bad actor.
I like
him. He's a good actor.
I like him.
Anyone who doubts that Topher Grace doesn't have the chops should see In Good Company.
Yeah, with
Dennis Quaid. And, of course, Scarlett Johansson.
Ooh. Calm down, son.
Tom likes Scarlett Johansson.
Obviously. I'm predicting that the movie is going to make $100 million the first weekend. It's on 4,000 screens, which is the largest opening of any movie in history.
It's going to make its money back. It's going to make tons of money. And there will definitely be a 4. The question is it going to be X-Men 3, or is it going to be Superman Returns?
For my money, I honestly don't see how they're going to get all these characters in with all these necessary stories. Something's got to suck.
Right.
And I'm 2.5 hours? Nah.
If Tobey Maguire wants to hang it up after 3, I say more power to him.
Absolutely.
The man is in his 30s. He's playing a 20-year-old.
Tobey, take your money and walk.
I don't understand why everybody is so freaked out by recasting. We've seen how many? 5 James Bonds now.
Well, it's like the same old gabagoo that I gotta hear every time when I say, hire Nathan Fillion or Dennis Quaid to play Indiana Jones and go do another.
Well, it looks like we're getting Shia LaBeouf.
Well, he's supposed to play Indiana Jones' son.
One of those
things.
What's
he playing? Henry Jones Jr. Jr.?
But you know what's gonna happen?
What?
At the end of the film, Harrison Ford's gonna hang it up.
Shia
LaBeouf's going to be the new Indiana Jones.
Exactly, yeah. Of course, which is perfectly all right.
But as long as they cast somebody good... One of the things, as you know, I appreciate about Batman Forever was the fact that they got an actor in Val Kilmer who studied Michael Keaton. And created a continuity. I don't mind if there's a new actor in Spider-Man 4 playing Peter Parker, as long as there is a continuity
in
the performance. Heck, I mean, we had three Kitty Prides in the three X-Men films. And there was a continuity for the characters.
Right. People get too freaked out about stuff. Oh, nobody else can play that. Blah, blah.
Well, if there's one time where I would have said, I wish they would have stayed with the original actor.
What?
It was when they decided to recast Harvey Dent in the Batman franchise. I wanted to see Billy Dee Williams as Two-Face.
I got jerked out of that because I would have really loved to see that. He would have wanted an interesting.
And now it looks like we're getting Liev Schreiber. Great act.
Who is my pick to play Al Bundy and Mary Winslow in the movie.
So we better wrap this up.
We gotta wrap it.
We hope we gave you some insight into Spider-Man. And
go out and enjoy the movie, by all means. That's the main thing. You go out, have you fun. Watch it, and have fun. And
don't
make up
care.
Your own mind.
I think far too often, this is something we're going to get to when we get to our Grindhouse episode, which will be coming up sometime this summer when the DVD release comes out, is that far too often audiences now get tied up with the numbers and what the critics think. You want to see a movie? Who gives a damn what some guy in a newspaper thinks? Who gives a damn what we think?
Amen.
Just go out and see. If it's bad, you can say, okay, you were right. If you enjoy it, you enjoy it. Far too often people equate success with quality.
Exactly.
Enjoy the movie. We'll be back with the Marvel at the Movies series around June.
Yeah, somewhere around
when it's time
there.
For the Fantastic Four.
The Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer.
Which I will say looks a hell of a lot better than what we got the last time.
Well, that's what I've been hearing. I've been hearing a lot of that everybody connected with it and have said this one should have been the first movie. They said they got it right this one.
At this point, we now have five scheduled, because we're going to do Fantastic Four, we're going to do the X-Men, we're doing the Blade trilogy, finally we'll be doing a catch-all for all the other stuff. So we'll be covering Daredevil and Elektra and Hulk. Mm-hmm. I'll maybe even talk a bit about Iron Man, which is coming up in 2008,
saw a picture of Robert Downey Jr.
As Tony Stark?
Yeah, as Tony Stark. And
interested in John. You heard, right? They just cast John Voight as Obadiah Stane.
Really? Okay.
Which to me, I'm like, now that's a choice I wouldn't have expected.
That's interesting. But I saw a picture of him. He looks like he's got the mask. And he looks like he's laid off the coke and the booze.
Right.
And he's been working out. He looks really buff.
Hey, Rachel McAdams playing Pepper Potts. Yep. That's perfect.
This is good.
Terrence Howard has James Rhodes.
I'm really looking forward to Iron Man. I really am.
Next time you hear us, we're going to be doing our summer preview special.
Okay.
And from Brooklyn, this has been Tom DJ.
And this has been Derek Ferguson.
And you've been listening to Better in the Dark. Take care of yourself. Oh!
What?
Our new Gmail address.
Oh.
If you guys want to mouth off to us and tell us we're stupid or
I'm sure you do.
Be sure to email us at betterinthedark. That's better and the letter N in the dark at gmail.com.
Maybe if we get enough, we'll do an entire episode and we'll just answer
telling you
emails.
How stupid you are. No, not really. Okay, folks. Have a good time, take care of yourselves, and go see that movie!
Bye-bye!
Who am I? You sure you want to know? The story of my life is not for the faint of heart. If somebody said it was a happy little tale, if somebody told you I was just your average, ordinary guy, not a care in the world, somebody lied.
You've been listening to Better in the Dark, featuring Derek Ferguson and Thomas DJ. Special thanks to Chris Johnson and the listeners of the Amazing Spider-Cast podcast at theamazingspidercast.podomatic.com, the Hollywood Saloon at www.hollywoodsaloon.com, and we even like Comic Geek Speak in spite of what we said, so give them a listen at www.comicgeekspeak.com. Sound clips were provided by www.spider-fan.org and www.myfavemovies.com. Better in the Dark does not recommend getting bit by radioactive spiders, lest you develop the ability to shoot webs out of your butt. Send all comments, praise, hate mail, and pipe bombs to betterinthedark@gmail.com. That's better, the letter N, thedark@gmail.com. Better in the Dark is a Conspiracy Productions presentation made in conjunction with Sci-Fi Fan Radio. All material copyright Thomas DJ and Derek Ferguson. Until next time, don't mock the guy with the fishbowl head.
You and I are not so different. I'm not like you. You're a murderer.
Well, to each his own.